Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We're beginning the hour with our Voices from the Opinion Pages segment. Today, the conservative view on what NATO does and doesn't spend to defend Europe. Doug Bondo wrote about it for the National Interest blog. We asked him to join us in the wake of President Trump's meetings in Europe last week. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he's with us today from Springfield, Virginia. Doug, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Happy to be on.
The logic of your argument about NATO and defense spending seems to go, watch what they do, not what they say, when it comes to Russia. But what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is there's a lot of talk about, you know, European countries being very worried about Russia. But if you're worried about Russia, you actually should spend money on your defense. You know, today, NATO Europe averages less than 1.5% of GDP on the military. That tells me they really aren't afraid of Russia. I mean, Germany's at 1.22%. Even the Baltic countries of Latvia and Lithuania are about 1.7, 1.8%. I mean, that tells me that, in fact, they feel relatively safe. They want the U.S. to do more, but they really aren't interested in spending a lot more themselves.
Your article actually seems to suggest that Russia isn't the threat that NATO makes them out to be. And you say in the piece, since Russia's occupation of Crimea and intervention in eastern Ukraine, there has been much fevered rhetoric about the Russian threat. A Hitler-esque Vladimir Putin was prepared to occupy the rest of Ukraine, swallow the three Baltic states, and sweep into Poland. Of course, you're saying that with a certain amount of sarcasm. Well, why isn't Putin the threat that NATO perceives him to be, or is he?
So I would argue that, I mean, he's a nasty guy. I mean, no one should have any illusions about that. But it looks to me like Russia today is essentially the great power Russia of, you know, pre-1914, pre the First World War. It cares about its security. It wants to be respected. It cares about its borders. But it doesn't have any kind of broad aspirations to kind of conquer and dominate other regions. And I've seen nothing to suggest that Vladimir Putin has the slightest interest in trying to rule non-Russians. I mean, you know, there's a good reason for him not to try to swallow Ukraine. It's indigestible. That, I mean, you would never try that if you're a rational person. You know, he's playing around in areas that have substantial ethnic Russian population. Crimea had a majority, was once part of Russia. But beyond that, I had people telling me, oh, he's going to attack Finland. You've had a lot of people coming up with scenarios on the Baltic countries. So far, we just don't see any of that. We don't even see deployments of his military that suggest anything like that.
So how, under how you've just explained this, what was the strategy behind what he did with Crimea? I mean, he believes that that territory should have always been Russia's, and that fits with your theory of how he thinks about this?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. You know, Crimea was an easy one. It was part of Russia until 1952, when in the Soviet Union it was handed over to Ukraine in a transfer that really didn't make any difference. Then it was probably part of internal Soviet politics. Well, and Crimea is important because it has the base Sebastopol, naval base into the Black Sea, and that's been a historically important military installation. And I think what happened is, you know, basically Putin was very fed up. He'd looked and said, look, NATO's expanding. You dismantled Serbia, our ally. You know, that now you're talking about bringing Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. I mean, these are historically, you know, very sensitive areas for Russia. And with the basically street putsch in 2014, where in Ukraine itself, I mean, there was a democratically elected, very corrupt, but still democratically elected president who leaned towards Russia. You know, the U.S. and Europe were very open in backing kind of a street putsch against that. You had chaos there. The government falls. Crimea was a very good opportunity for him. You know, the place is in chaos. You know, the people there seem to want Russia. You grab it. I think that he thought he might get more with the eastern, you know, sections, hoping maybe they'd break off of Ukraine. That didn't happen.
I see.
It was a crime of opportunity, essentially, but relatively limited in scope. Again, geographically, not interested in conquering Ukraine, but interested in weakening it and ensuring that it did not become part of NATO. That was really what he was up to. He was not trying to be a conqueror.
Let me ask you something about how Putin sees NATO. We've had Molly McHugh on the show several times, and a Russian Russia expert, and she says that much of what Putin does geopolitically is aimed at weakening NATO because he sees it as an important opposing force to his ambitions. What's your view of how Putin sees NATO and why there's a lot of the strategy that he undertakes seems to be pointed at NATO?
Well, I think NATO is a historically anti-Moscow alliance. I mean, NATO was created against the Soviet Union. And even today, I mean, clearly there's one power which it's really directed against, and that's Russia. And I do think he's probably been affected by the color revolutions that the U.S. and the allies have supported. You know, people talking about regime change, that he does not particularly trust the U.S. He sees the U.S. as having, you know, taken advantage of the fall of the Soviet Union and kind of strengthened America geopolitically, put, you know, Russia at a great disadvantage. And in his view, basically, the allies were deceptive, for example, in Libya, saying they wanted to protect civilians, but taking advantage of the opportunity, again, to impose regime change. So I think there's a lot that goes there. I mean, you know, there's an old saying that even paranoids have enemies, that while I don't think that NATO has any aggressive intentions, you can imagine, you know, sitting in Moscow having a different perception when you've been kind of watching allied behavior over the years.
So it sounds like you agree with what she says. A lot of what he, how he thinks about this and does is because he perceives NATO as a barrier to his ambitions, and he would like to weaken NATO.
Yeah, but I say barrier to ambitions, it's not the ambition that he really would like to try to launch an attack to the Atlantic Ocean and conquer Europe. I don't think that is anywhere in his ambitions. I think what he sees it as a constraining force and a potentially dangerous force. So, you know, his ambitions, I think, in many ways are to be more influential,
right,
be more secure, as opposed to kind of conquer the continent.
That's really what I meant by that. I mean, he isn't his calculation. He accrues more power and influence if he can split and weaken the influence of NATO, not in a geographic sense, in a geopolitical sense.
Yeah, I think that's right. Exactly.
Call here for you from John in Fridley. Hi, John. What are you thinking about?
Well, you're a guest, and sorry, sir, I forgot your name, but you were asserting that Russia is a rational actor when it invaded Crimea and Ukraine. And one could reasonably expect, prior to those invasions, that you would see the kind of economic sanctions and the economic suffering that Russia has seen since the invasion. And so I'm a little curious as to how we're coming to how we're assuming the basis of Russia as a rational actor, when realistically these days it's not necessarily territory that you hold that defines you. It's the size of your economy, which Russia is not seeing a very good result with.
Doug?
But it's not just size of economy. He gained politically. His approval ratings went up greatly. To some degree, he got over some of the economic difficulties by basically presenting himself as the defender of the Russian nation. Nationalism plays a very powerful role. I mean, the U.S. is in very low esteem in Russia. It's been for a number of years. He's not the only Russian who thinks that the U.S. has kind of played them false. I mean, that doesn't mean the U.S. has, but the reality is Russians themselves are not that happy with the U.S., and he's hardly the most rabid nationalist there. So that calculation of benefit has a lot more. And beyond that, I think he thought he wouldn't hit all these sanctions. There are European states that didn't want to do them. I mean, there are countries there that have always been divided on the issue. I suspect he may have miscalculated. You know, the fact you're rational doesn't mean you don't make mistakes. And sometimes we have our biggest problems because people make misjudgments, you know, kind of live in a dream world, and then the results are catastrophic for everyone.
Doug Bondo is with us this morning. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. And we're talking about a piece that he wrote for the National Interest blog about NATO and the spending that they do in their own defense and some of the critiques that President Trump has made about that. So here's a question, Doug. I mean, do you get the sense that President Trump, then candidate Trump, bringing up the fact, as you've raised it again in this piece, that NATO doesn't spend the amount of money that they should on their own defense, 2% or more, has wrought any kind of change within the NATO alliance? I mean, is President Trump having any kind of a positive effect on this?
I think that there's certainly much more public attention, and the Europeans have more kind of publicly said, oh, yes, we're going to do something. And you know, everybody now says that by 2024,
right,
we'll meet the 2% deadline. I don't think anybody really believes that, but they're saying that. So I think he's forced that. I think some of the trends that we're seeing right now, they're very modest, a few percent, were probably already happening. I mean, it started in 2015. You know, the NATO spending was going down consistently to 2014, edged up very marginally 2015, a little more last year. I think those numbers were going up anyway. So his impact is small. He'll take credit for it, no doubt. But I do think that, you know, a lot of this is public relations.
Yeah, I guess what I was asking, is the nagging working? And I think I hear you saying they were on a trajectory where they were gradually increasing their commitments and supposedly reaching 2% of GDP by 2024. In fact, you doubt that that will happen, that they'll get to that point?
Look, I mean, Germany right now is at 1.22%. I mean, does anyone really believe that in the next few years they're going to almost double their spending? The opposition SPD party is strongly against it. Even the ruling party is not overly enthused. We don't know what kind of coalition shows up in, you know, September. I just don't believe it'll be sustained. And I think that's the case in a number of these countries. The reality is, I go back to, I don't think the people there perceive the threat. If they don't perceive the threat, then how do you convince them to spend the money when they have a lot of economic problems to deal with?
Doug, do you join other Republicans and conservatives who are somewhat mystified by the president's continued warmth for Putin and for Russia? In light of everything the intelligence agencies are telling us and lots of other evidence, to the contrary, that he should be regarded quite warily.
Well, look, I mean, the way the president judges people is, shall we say, unique. I mean, I'd have the same reaction, frankly, on his newfound fondness for the Saudi royals.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Saudi Arabia is a totalitarian state. These people have funded terrorism even more than Qatar, which, you know, they're attacking Qatar over. What motivates him? I mean, he's been very nice to people like al-Sisi in Egypt, who's quite a brute. So, I mean, it's hard to, you know, assess why he likes who he does. So, yeah, I think it's a little odd. I think we have to deal with Putin. I mean, but I think we need to recognize who we're dealing with, what we're dealing with, and have no illusions.
Well, but I mean, do you get the sense that President Trump understands what you've just said? Recognize who we're dealing with and have no illusions. That I have to say, that seems rather puzzling after this latest meeting.
I do wonder. I think that he has a tendency to, I think he's a sort of person who has preconceptions, and it's very hard to break those preconceptions. And for whatever reason, his preconception on Putin was more positive, I think, than warranted, and it's not clear to me that he's really given that up.
Doug, a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you.
Sure thing. Happy to be on.
Doug Bondo wrote about NATO and Russia and the U.S. for the National Interest blog. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute.